Support comes from the Wexner Center for the Arts, presenting the Fred Hirsch Trio Friday, March 28th in the Wex Performance Space. The Cincinnati native and pianist performs his original compositions and classic jazz tunes from such artists as Miles Davis and Sonny Rollins. Tickets and details online at wexarts.org.
Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. 4 years ago, President Obama signed the Patient Protection and Affordable Care Act into law. Its goal was to expand access to health care coverage and reduce overall health care spending. The law has faced heated opposition, suffered through a disastrous website rollout late last year, and since then, multiple delays. Now, enrollment deadline is just days away. We'll consider the latest facts and figures, whether they square with the White House's projections, and what it means for the average consumer, whatever that means. Joining us by phone from her Washington, D.C. office is Kaiser Health News senior correspondent Mary Agnes Carey. Welcome back to the show.
Thanks for having me.
Do we know how many people have signed up through the health insurance exchanges now?
Right. The most recent number was about 5 million people. Now, federal officials have said they've had a real surge in interest. As we know, the enrollment deadline is March 31st. It's coming up on Monday. So if you're interested in enrolling, it's a good time to check it out. So the goal set by the Congressional Budget Office, which is kind of an unofficial scorekeeper here in Washington, they had estimated that perhaps 6 million people would enroll. Whether or not they'll hit the 6 million is unclear. But the most important thing about that enrollment period is not necessarily the number, but it's more about who's in that risk pool. Do you have, are they mostly sick people? Are they mostly healthy people? How do they balance out the risks? And that will affect prices going into 2015.
Now, the White House was hoping for a number, or I would imagine the CBO at this point was hoping for a number closer to 7 million, right?
That was the initial number, but as you noted, they had a disastrous rollout when the exchanges opened up in October. So based on all those computer problems and the complications, that 7 million number was revised down to 6 million.
I would imagine there has been a surge in recent weeks because of the deadline approaching. Have there been any problems with the systems during what would arguably be the next biggest period of time?
Yesterday, federal officials said that they had had a few minor problems that were corrected quickly. They also talked about record traffic, 1.2 million people coming to the website on Tuesday, 500,000 people calling the 800 number on Monday and Tuesday. They expect this surge to continue, and they are very hopeful that the website will be able to handle it. But in case it can't, yesterday officials said if you're in the queue, if you tried to enroll by the 31st and couldn't, that you will have additional time to complete your application. So they're doing everything they can to get in as many people as possible and get them enrolled.
You're listening to All Sides with Dan Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. The deadline for enrolling, if you don't already have insurance in the Affordable Care Act or in Obamacare, however you want to call it, is Monday. My guest is Mary Agnes Carey, Kaiser Health News senior correspondent. If you have a question or comment, give us a call, 614-292-8513. We'll be hearing from a critic of the Affordable Care Act coming up later in the program, and also hear from Enroll America, the organization largely charged with getting more people enrolled. Do we have an idea of the breakdown age-wise of enrollees? You said that, you know, that who enrolls is more important than how many at this point. And getting young people to sign up is what we focus on a lot. But isn't it more about healthy people?
It is. It really depends on who's in the risk pool. For example, current numbers are about 55% of the people that have enrolled are women, about 45% are men. And about a quarter of those are in that ideal demographic, that 18 to 34 range. Those people tend to be healthier. But about 70% of enrollees so far are ages 35 and older. In an interview I did last week with the head of the health insurance major trade group, she said one of the experiences they've seen so far is that the people that have currently enrolled are using a lot of services. They already knew that. They knew some of the sickest people would get in first. But their hope is some more healthy people will come in at the end. They may be the younger folks who are going to wait perhaps to the last minute to enroll, and that experience will balance out the risk pool.
If you don't enroll at all, What are the consequences?
If you don't enroll for health insurance by March 31st and you don't fit one of the qualifications for an exemption, there is a penalty. For the first year, it's $95 or 1% of income, whichever is higher. So for most people, the penalty is not going to be $95. It's going to be that 1% of income. People often focus on the dollar amount and not the 1%, but that's important to note. That is for the first year, and that's going to continue to rise in 2016 for an individual. That amount goes to $695 or 2.5% of income. And it's the more people in the household, the larger the penalty. So there is a penalty out there if you don't enroll.
Is that income based on the household or the individual?
It would be your household income. And it's above the threshold for filing. So there's a standard exemption, and then there's the amount above that that is taxed at that percentage.
For somebody that's, say, 17 years old, who's responsible for signing them up?
That would be their parents. They'd still be a minor. They're very likely. The key indicator there is if you are a deduction on the parents' tax return,
okay,
then the parents have that responsibility.
One more burden.
It never ends.
It never ends is right. What happens if there aren't enough healthy people paying premiums or enrolled in the affordable care? Do we know what that tipping point is and what happens if we don't reach it?
I don't think we know exactly what the tipping point is, but if you didn't draw enough healthier people and the claims were higher than anticipated by the health insurance industry, that could reflect in higher premiums for next year. The insurers in a few months will have to submit their bids for the 2015 plan year. That enrollment period for that opens up in November. So as those bids are submitted by the health insurance industry, reviewed by federal officials, and then put the figures put into the website so people will know in November what the premiums are, then we'll get a good idea of what the experience was for the first year.
Now, for people who have been paying premiums for the last 25 or 30 years, they've been going up anyway.
That's right.
Higher premiums are not, to anyone who's already been paying in, that's not unusual.
It isn't unusual. Those increases have slowed in the last few years.
Mm-hmm.
Some people think it's due to the economy, perhaps. Some people think it may be that the population is trying to get healthier and stay healthier, that some practices, medical practices, are changing that try to promote more prevention. Perhaps that's helping. Nobody really knows. Last week at a congressional hearing, Kathleen Sebelius, who's the head of the Department of Health and Human Services, was asked point blank, will health insurance premiums increase next year? She said she believed that they would, mm-hmm. but they would increase to a lower degree than if you didn't have the health insurance law. Now, that'll be of great debate, but as you note, people who've been paying their own health insurance premiums, and even those of us who get it through our work, have mm-hmm. seen those increase steadily throughout the years.
Right. And what they're getting for that is much greater than, say, that when I was 21, I had, or however old I was when I first started insuring myself, was kind of one of those major catastrophe.
Right.
It wasn't horribly expensive, but it wasn't horribly helpful either. It was just to keep my parents from going bankrupt to save my life.
Right. The insurance now, that is the new plans, have to offer what's called the essential health benefits. There are these 10 categories of coverage. It's going to have all sorts of things in there: hospitalization, doctor's visits, drugs, pediatric care, maternity care. That's been some source of friction because there are some people that say, I'm not planning on having a family. I don't have kids. Why do I have to pay for that in an insurance policy? But the thought was, with the creators of the Affordable Care Act, they wanted to have a comprehensive set of services. And also, in some cases, not all, but in some cases, people who bought more scaled-back plans didn't realize that until, for example, they're in the hospital. They don't understand they've got a cap of maybe $2,000 on hospital coverage in their plan, and they don't realize it until it's too late.
And that is not the case anymore. Now they don't have those.
You don't have annual limits on coverage.
Right.
You don't have lifetime limits anymore. But again, if you make policies more comprehensive, the concern is, what does that do to the cost. The federal estimates have been very, very small increases in cost. But again, we're going to have to see how it plays out in the marketplace and what the prices are for 2015 in the exchanges. I think that'll be a really interesting way to look at to see what adding all this coverage has done to the cost of health insurance.
Already, over the last couple years, we've been talking about the ACA actually rolled out a couple years ago, starting with coverage of children, expanding it.
Right. One of the very first things they said was that you could not discriminate against a child based on a pre-existing condition. That was one of the earliest things. And so that was an early benefit. Again, another early benefit that came online was preventive services without a copay or a deductible. Lifetime limits, lifting those was an early benefit. Getting rid of something called rescissions, which is when an insurer could come back after you'd have been applied and accepted and rescind the coverage. That only is allowed now in cases of fraud if you lied on your application. So there were a lot of early benefits that came out. And then starting this year, we've had coverage through the exchanges that kicked in on January the 1st. So it was kind of a long rollout. The president signed the Affordable Care Act into law in 2010. Here we are 4 years later in 2014, now just seeing some of the exchange coverage and the Medicaid expansion kick in, which are some of the key elements of the law.
All healthcare plans are now required to cover contraceptives, and that has been another sticking point. Hobby Lobby, a craft store chain owned by a conservative Christian group family, objects to that stipulation and has gone to the Supreme Court over it. Can you tell us what's going on with that?
They had the oral argument earlier this week. Basically, Hobby Lobby is saying, even though we're as a corporation, we have, as you note, very strong religious views on some FDA, Food and Drug Administration, approved contraceptives. Covering those particular items would be religiously objectionable to us. And so the question is whether, as a corporation, Hobby Lobby has the same rights as an individual on religious freedom. There was a really spirited debate back and forth, lots of questions from the justices. And it was interesting. I went to a briefing with some colleagues who had attended the oral argument, and they're very, very smart folks, and they've written extensively about it. And they walked out saying they really couldn't tell which way this was going to go. So I think it's one of those important decisions for the healthcare law. People are expecting it very late in the term, perhaps near the end of June. That's where, if you remember the earlier court challenge on the individual mandate, and the justices also ruled on the Medicaid expansion, that very important decision came at the end of the term, like the end of June. So we're thinking that's going to happen again in this case.
When it comes to the contraceptives thing, that doesn't mean that you have to take contraceptives. It just means that the insurance covers it.
That's right, that insurance covered it. And they've made some accommodations in the law. For example, if you are a church, contraception, you work for the church, the church does not like the idea of contraception, they don't have to cover it. The difficulty has been in the religiously affiliated institutions like a Catholic university, for example, a Catholic hospital.
That may employ lots of people who are not part of that religion.
Exactly. Right. And so the accommodation the administration came up with months ago came out and said, you don't have to provide contraceptive services. You don't have to pay for those on your package. You can have the insurer get in touch with your employees and offer this separately. And the administration is saying that for example, the religiously affiliated university or hospital doesn't have to pay for it. The insurer will pay for it, and the insurer will do that because this is deemed cost effective because you're preventing pregnancies. But that's going to be another challenge coming down the line, because there are some religious organizations that say, wait a minute, if we don't believe in contraception, we don't want anyone working here to be covered by that, because it's a benefit in some cases they've never offered that. And it's a benefit maybe we haven't offered, we don't want to be required to offer. And so that's another whole set of legal challenges that are working their way through the system.
The deadline for enrolling in affordable care in the health insurance program provided by the Affordable Care Act is March 31st, this coming Monday. My guest is Mary Agnes Carey with the Kaiser Health News, where she's a senior correspondent. Coming up, we're going to hear from a healthcare and policy scholar and critic of Obamacare. So stay with us. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides. I'm Ann Fisher. The enrollment deadline is just days away for the Affordable Care Act, signed into law 4 years ago. The law has faced major opposition from many Republicans and others who aren't convinced the Affordable Care Act can achieve the goal of expanded, improved, and less expensive coverage. While the Obama administration has launched a campaign to encourage young people to sign up before the March 31st deadline, opponents of the ACA have worked to highlight the law's unaffordability.
This new plan is not affordable at all. My husband is working a lot more hours just to pay for these new increases. I'm frustrated that government has caused this huge problem for our family. It feels like a kick in the gut.
Still with us is Kaiser Health News senior correspondent Mary Agnes Carey. Joining us now by phone as well from Washington, D.C. is healthcare and policy scholar at the American Enterprise Institute, Joe Antos. Welcome to the show.
Thank you.
The sign-up procedure aside for the moment, some healthy people see this as a bad deal for them. Why is that?
Well, it's a bad deal in the sense that the Department of Health and Human Services made decisions about what had to be covered by insurance. And there are some 17 million people who were buying health insurance on their own in the individual market. The numbers are a little vague here, but probably some 5 million people lost their coverage because their policies were no longer met the federal standards. So they had to buy new coverage. Undoubtedly, many of them went to the exchanges because they had previously bought coverage. They wanted to buy coverage again, obviously. And many of them found that the premiums are higher than they'd been paying, that the deductibles were often higher than were required. And some people say that the networks were narrower. That's a little harder to demonstrate. The basic problem is that the coverage that HHS says you have to have is broader. It includes some very expensive services that people who were buying their insurance on their own without any federal subsidy didn't typically pay for.
As far as the cancellation, starting about mid last year, people were getting letters that their policies had been canceled. What was happening with that, Mary Agnes Carey? To what extent was that connected directly to Obamacare?
Well, if they were renewing, they weren't. There are some policies that are grandfathered for a variety of reasons; they don't change. But if the policy had changed and they were renewing it, then, as Joe said, they had to meet these essential health benefits. Prerequisites, and that has caused some concern. There was an accommodation the president said in November. If you're in a plan in the individual market that was canceled, if your insurer wanted to still offer that plan, and if your state insurance commissioner said it could be offered, you could extend your coverage for a year. The administration recently now gave folks another 2 years for that extension. But again, for that coverage to continue, the insurer has to continue to offer it, which they could have canceled it any time before the health law came along. Sometimes they would renew those policies, sometimes they wouldn't. And the insurance commissioner would have to say that it could be offered. And for example, in California, their insurance commissioner that has a lot of regulatory power said, no, we don't want these canceled policies to be offered. We want the coverage to meet the health law standards. So that's kind of some of the background there.
Joe, isn't it a good deal for the rest of us whose insurance rates have been based on a healthcare system that takes care of people, even those who are uninsured or underinsured, often at greater expense?
I'm not sure what you mean by a good deal. Most people who look at this don't quite understand that taxes are also going to increase. And I don't just mean the taxes directly related to the health system. I mean general taxation. The likelihood that Congress will in fact sustain the very, very large cuts in Medicare, which are the major reason why the ACA was calculated by the Congressional Budget Office to not increase the deficit. Pretty unlikely. Congress is unlikely to enforce the kinds of cuts that are in the ACA, and they're already moving to once again push aside the 24% reduction in physician payment rates that was also assumed in the law back in 2010. So we are looking at a serious budget problem that's going to translate into potentially either higher general taxation or certainly higher premiums paid by everybody else. Because even if you have coverage that met all of the HHS standards, I want to emphasize that these are HHS standards. These are not standards that are built into the law. The law has some requirements, but HHS expanded well beyond them. The fact is that people will be paying more money for insurance. The idea that we won't be continuing to cover people who don't have insurance, who go to the emergency room for one reason or another and don't have coverage, we're still going to be doing that. It's not quite a zero-sum game, but I don't think you can argue that we are all gaining from this. Somebody has to pay. Mm-hmm. Somebody receives.
Mm-hmm. Hasn't it been the way it has been, though, anyway? Before now,
right? We are rearranging the deck chairs on the healthcare
okay.
Titanic, and that's part of the complaint that people are having, because the people who are losing probably weren't paying much attention to this law, and you know, you hear the rhetoric, you don't think you're going to lose money. And the people who are gaining, a lot of them still haven't signed up because many of them are really quite unaware of the deadlines and the requirements and the options that they have.
We're going to be talking to somebody from Enroll America's Ohio office later on in the program, but Mary Agnes Carey from Kaiser Health News, what more do people need to know that there's a deadline coming up? Is there some gap out there that you're aware of as a journalist that the Obama administration, that Enroll America has failed to span?
Well, you have to remember that there's been a lot of outreach lately, and that's really important before the deadline for anything to try to get people aware of it. But for some reason, perhaps because of the complexity of the law, the message is not getting through. For example, my colleagues at the Kaiser Family Foundation just released a poll yesterday, which I found amazing, some of the results. 40% of people who are uninsured under 65 said they would plan to sign up by the month's end for exchanges, right? But 50% of them said they plan to remain without insurance. Only 4 in 10 knew about the March 31st deadline. A third of those were surveyed didn't even know they'd face a fine. I've often wondered if there's some sort of Harvard Business School study thing involved in the rollout of the health law to look at how it was communicated to the public. You've got to remember, too, with the problems with the website, they really lost October. They lost most of November. And then near the end of November, they fixed it. So in December was really the push to try to get people enrolled for coverage starting on January the 1st. So the website problem definitely hurt the outreach campaign. But most of the website problems, according to federal officials, were fixed near the end of November. So we've had January, February, and March. And the real press on the PR campaign has happened in the last few weeks, but it just does not seem like it's getting through. I think that Joe's right. People just don't spend a lot of time talking about their health insurance, thinking about it. They've got their jobs and their families and so on, and it's not really that sexy of a topic to think about, your health insurance. And so maybe all that is playing a part in sort of the gaps in public awareness about this.
Joe Antos, Do you think that there was a reason to address health care coverage in the United States 4 years ago, or even go back 25 years to the Clinton administration? Is there a problem? Was there a problem?
Well, I think there's been a problem for a lot of people for a lot longer than that.
Mm-hmm.
The idea that people with pre-existing conditions couldn't get coverage, or that those conditions wouldn't be covered in some way, that's very difficult because it's oftentimes these are expensive conditions, and the average person may not be able to afford the kind of treatment that we actually, thanks to modern technology, over the last 15 or 20 years, we've got some miracle treatments, but they're miraculously expensive as well. So I think the situation in healthcare has changed. It was time to change some of the ground rules, but the way the ACA did it was to overlook certain realities of life. In particular, it's very difficult to sell a product if people don't like it. That's leaving aside whether they fully understand the complexities of the health insurance market. But I think the biggest problem now for the people who aren't signing up, who have gone on the website, is that they simply don't like what they see. Frankly, the insurance industry their advice should have been taken. If you want to sell insurance, don't tell people to give up their cable television service to buy insurance. People, that's not a positive message. And don't tell young people that the reason they should sign up is to take care of mom and dad. In many families,
so depressing.
Mine in particular, that wouldn't be a good message.
It's really depressing, but I think you're right about that. So what if, Joe Antos, what if the Affordable Care Act was abolished tomorrow and Republicans had their way in Congress over that? They say they're talking about a replacement, an alternative, but what would happen? I mean, now that it's underway, so to speak, now that we're close to the deadline, do you think it's something we, the nation has to live with and tweak and fiddle with, over time, like it has other big programs like this, or not?
Absolutely. We have to start from where we are, not from where we're not. A lot about the health insurance industry has changed over the past 4 years. It wasn't just in the past 6 months. A lot of those changes the public really likes and are quite appropriate. So the idea that, for example, insurers, that we're going to pull back on people being able to stay with their parents' plan up to the age of 26, insurers like it because it's more customers. People think it's a good idea. Young people who can't get jobs, who might be thinking about health insurance, really think it's a good idea. There are lots of other things that I think we'll keep. The idea of exchanges. Bluntly, that is a kind of a conservative, I don't want to say Republican, but a conservative idea, giving people choices and giving them information. That's baked into the fabric now, I think. But it doesn't mean that things are going to stay the same. Obviously, the administration has belatedly and it seems like every day finds a new problem that they change a rule on. That's going to continue to happen, and if the presidential election goes Republican way, that president might say he or she is abolishing the ACA, but the reality is that much of this is locked in concrete, and we need to make some responsible changes.
I have an email from Tammy. She says, if I have the same insurance I have had for 5 years, do I need to drop it and sign up for Obamacare? Mary Agnes Carey, we still get questions like that.
I would assume if she's being offered the ability to continue that coverage, then she's fine. I mean, if the plan weren't compliant with the essential health benefits, if there was some issue, wasn't compliant with the health law, I don't think the insurer would be allowed to offer it. So if she's getting an offer to keep that, it's probably grandfathered plan. It hasn't changed. She should be fine.
Okay. And let's take a quick call from John in Cleveland. You're on the air. Hi, John. John, you're on the air?
No, just saying, John, this is Mark.
All right. Well, Mark, guess what? It's you on the air, and the screener got the name wrong. So welcome to the show. That's okay.
I have a question. I'm 53 years old. I've been unemployed for like a year and a half. unemployment just run out. I can't afford it. So is there going to be a penalty if I'm not signed up by the end of the month?
Okay. Mary Agnes Carey?
Sure. That's a great question. A couple of ideas for you. You could find out if you can get a subsidy on the exchange. A couple of ways you can do that. If you have access to a computer, you can go to healthcare.gov. They'll ask you a variety of questions about who you are and your income level and help you determine if you can get a subsidy and pay for a plan. If you went through that process and you found out that this, even with the subsidy, it's too expensive for you, I think the line on that is it's got to, if it's more than about 9.5% of your income, even to pay your share, that you could get an exemption from the mandate. But my feeling is that based on if you've had unemployment, it's been discontinued, you don't have a job, you don't have a regular income, you're going to qualify for a subsidy not only with your premium, but possibly also for copays and deductibles on a policy. If you don't have a computer or you're not comfortable with it, you can find out perhaps at a local community center or a senior center. There are things called navigators and assisters. They're all over the place. You've got a guest from Enroll America who's going to be on shortly who might be able to also help pinpoint where you can get some assistance. But I would see if you can get some help under the health law.
All right. John, or Mark, thanks a lot for that call. We will continue this conversation, but Joe Antos, healthcare and policy scholar at the American Enterprise Institute, I want to thank you for joining us today.
Thank you.
And Mary Agnes Carey of the Kaiser Health News, where you're a senior correspondent, thank you as well for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Coming up, we're going to hear from Trey Daly, Enroll America's Ohio representative. So we'll get to some of those calls, questions, and more emails. You can call us at 614-292-8513 or email us at allsides@wosu.org. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.
Budget, so don't accept defeat.
Now you can get covered and still
buy me treats.
Welcome back to All Sides. I'm Ann Fisher. That was an ad from the group Enroll America. The video that accompanies it features an array of domestic pets, dogs, cats, and parakeets, urging their owners to sign up for the Affordable Care Act. I guess if you won't listen to the president, maybe your beloved pooch can get through to you. Ohioans have been especially sluggish to sign up. As of March 1st, about 80,000 had enrolled through the Federal Health Care Exchange. That's about half of the federal government's goal for the state. But Enroll America's representative, Trey Daly, is not discouraged. He joins us now by phone. Welcome back, Trey.
Good morning, Ann.
I wanted to grab some caller right away and just hear how the Affordable Care Act has helped her. Mary Beth in Columbus, you're on the air. Welcome, Mary Beth.
Hi, great to be here. I just want to say that I'm actually part of the Invincibles, so to speak, the 18 to 35-year-olds, and I have incredibly rare illnesses. I have a heart condition, five separate heart conditions, a spine disease that caused me to have five back surgeries by the time I was 28 years old. I have been dropped from coverage before, and because of the Affordable Care Act, I don't have to worry about that anymore. Not only do I not have to worry about that, but on top of that, I also don't have to worry about lifetime caps. I would have met my lifetime cap within a matter of a few years if it wasn't for the Affordable Care Act. And every time, quite frankly, they vote to repeal, it scares me because I'm thinking, okay, am I one diagnosis away from being back in that limbo zone again of, all right, is my coverage going to be dropped?
Well, Mary Beth, and, you are in that age group, so you know lots of people in your age group then
yes.
that don't have your burdens. And what do you hear from them about what they're being asked to pay?
Well, actually, six out of ten people can actually get enrolled and get a plan for $100 or less. And I think that's been out there. And most people in my age group, we get our information from Twitter, and that's all over the Twitterverse. It's
okay.
been very well out there and documented. And I feel so passionately about this. I've gone out there and done flyering to get people. And, you know, I've done it even there at Columbus State Community College. And they desperately want this coverage. It's not that they don't want it. I think everybody realizes that we're just, you know, with this weather we've been having, a slip of the ice away or mm-hmm. a car wreck away from a devastating medical bill. It does. You don't have to be in the position like me where you have the diagnosis and, you know, Cleveland Clinic is practically, you know, my home away from home. You don't have to be in that position. We're all just a trip or, you know, mm-hmm. just a simple fender bender away from needing vital health insurance.
Okay.
And the old system before was all based on sick care, which made no sense whatsoever. Wouldn't we much rather catch somebody when they have high cholesterol, when they're in their late 20s, early 30s, then catch them when they're in their 40s, and then we're paying for, you know, a quadruple bypass when they have no coverage because they didn't go see doctors? With the Affordable Care Act now, we have it to where you can go in, your
right.
physicals are covered.
Okay.
I think it's a much broader approach than what most people realize, and it gives people with insurance the security of knowing that we're not going to be dropped if we're one more diagnosis or we're one more thing away from it. We're not going to be dropped. We're not going to meet our lifetime cap.
So Trey Daly, is Mary Beth on the payroll or something? Or
no.
I feel like
I don't
need
all.
To say anything else. She's told such a wonderful story, and I feel so great for her. It's so rewarding to hear these stories and the many stories that I've been hearing over the last few weeks of people who not only are finally getting access to the health care that they need, are getting relieved of the burden of potential medical debt, but mostly relieved from that anxiety about what is going to happen to me if I don't have health coverage or if I'm afraid of my health coverage disappearing. And so it is so great to hear that real people like Mary Beth are receiving real benefits from the Affordable Health Care Act.
Well, Mary Beth, thanks for that call. We appreciate it. We had a caller who said that Mark from Columbus, who called a few minutes ago, or I think it was Cleveland, who said he'd been laid off. He ran out of his unemployment and he can't afford health care. Someone suggested he might qualify or he would qualify for Medicaid because there's been a Medicaid expansion in Ohio.
Right. So under Ohio's expanded Medicaid program, the only eligibility consideration at this point is income. So for a single person, if you have income below $16,000 a year, roughly, you will qualify for expanded Medicaid, which will provide comprehensive health coverage with little to no out-of-pocket expenses. And so, you know, this is for people who are working in low-wage jobs or who are temporarily out of work. Folks who in the past have not been able to qualify for Medicaid can now fairly easily enroll in the expanded Medicaid program.
Let's hear from Brian in Grandview. You wanted to talk about the link between the Medicaid expansion and ACA?
Correct. So if somebody is unemployed and does not have any coverage, should they pursue the expanded Medicaid as opposed to the Obamacare?
That's a good
so
question.
If you have no income, if you have no income at this point, Medicaid is really the best option for you. In fact, a little quirk in the law is that people who have income between 0 and 100% of the federal poverty guidelines can't qualify for tax credit to purchase private insurance on the health insurance marketplace. So really the best option for them is Medicaid. And if your situation changes, no problem. If you become no longer financially eligible for Medicaid, you can then explore and purchase a private policy through the health insurance marketplace, even though it's after March 31st, outside of the regular open enrollment period. Losing Medicaid coverage would be one of those special life circumstances that would allow you to enroll in private coverage beyond March 31st.
Okay. Brian, thanks a lot for that call. Robert in Canton. Hi, Robert. You're on the air.
Good morning. Thanks for taking my call.
You're welcome.
Everybody right now is focused on the big picture, total enrollment, and the number of young people getting insurance. But I was wondering if Kaiser Health News or other members of your panel were getting any reports on people having problems qualifying for financial aid when they apply for health insurance. In my case, I believe I qualify for both premium subsidies and lower health care costs, but the healthcare insurance marketplace has failed to generate any financial aid for me through the application process. Mm-hmm. So after trying to apply multiple times since late November, health insurance marketplace representatives told me my only alternative is to file an appeal on what essentially is a software glitch. Again, I was just wondering if any members of your panel have heard about problems like these.
Well, with us now solely is Trey Daly from Enroll America's Ohio office. Trey, what do you make of Robert's situation?
Well, what I'm hearing is that by and large, people are getting through the healthcare.gov health insurance marketplace application process fairly easily. We're not seeing the same kind of computer glitches that we saw in October and November of last year. However, there are times that there are folks are encountering difficulties, and that's why there is an appeal process in place so that those kinds of issues can be resolved. And so if somebody's having that kind of problem and it's not resolved by March 1st or March 31st, they will be okay. They wouldn't be subject to a penalty because they're encountering this kind of problem with the application
But they
process.
Still won't have insurance.
That's right. And that's, you know, that's when we talk about penalties, that's the most significant penalty is when you're not able to access health coverage. I'd encourage folks like Robert, if he hasn't already done so, to check out something like the calculator that we have at our getcoveredamerica.org website or the calculator that's accessible through healthcare.gov to get an estimate of what your tax credit should be and what the impact would be on the premiums for coverage available in your community. And if there's a difference between what those calculators are saying and what healthcare.gov is saying, then it definitely makes sense to appeal that decision. And it also makes sense to reach out to one of the certified enrollment assisters in the community who may have, through their experience, some ways of getting around these kinds of barriers.
Where do you find those people?
Well, there's a few ways to do that. One is going to healthcare.gov, the health insurance marketplace, mm-hmm. or also to getcoveredamerica.org. Both of them have local help finders where you just need to plug in your zip code and it'll give you a list of the folks who have been certified by the federal government to provide free, unbiased, certified application assistance. And these are folks who can sit down with you next to the laptop, work through the process. They now have lots of experience with that and have tricks up their sleeve.
And they can help with the appeal process as well?
Either they can help with the appeal process or they can connect you to organizations like the legal aid societies around the state that can provide assistance with that.
Okay. All right, Robert, good luck with that. Andy and Powell, you're on the air. Hi, Andy.
Hi, I have a question. I've heard that people who are 70 or older don't actually have the requirement to join this system. Is that true? Is there any truth to that or not? And the other comment I'll make is that this is such a convoluted system, it seems to me it would have made more sense to offer a basic government-paid plan for people who are below a certain income level, and let it just be a free market above a certain income level. But that's you know, this
water down the
hybrid.
Drain. Yeah,
yeah, that's right. That's water down the drain. Question yeah. was, but, though, is that information correct or
do
not?
So what is the age limit for signing up, Trey Daly?
Well, the key thing is the marketplace is primarily targeted to folks through age 64, with the thought being that most folks who are 65 or older have Medicare coverage, either as a result of retirement or disability. And so if you have Medicare, you're considered to have qualifying health coverage, so that the coverage that you would get through the marketplace wouldn't be any better than the coverage that you already have through Medicare. So it is correct that folks on Medicare, who generally folks over 65 are on Medicare, can't qualify for financial assistance to purchase coverage through the marketplace because they already have coverage that is comparable to the coverage available there.
Okay. So not necessary to even sign up. You just, you're covered under Medicare.
Right. Medicare beneficiaries don't have to do anything. They receive some other benefits through the Affordable Care Act, such as getting access to preventive health care with no out-of-pocket expenses, or having the so-called donut hole is closing, so they're out-of-pocket medication expenses have been decreasing. But in terms of the health insurance marketplace and the policies offered through there and the mandate to have coverage, folks on Medicare have already satisfied that responsibility.
Okay. Andy from Powell, thanks for that call. Email from Mary. She says, for those of us who are self-employed and our incomes vary year to year. For example, I'm a writer and this year I made $100,000, but next year I'll make $30,000. How will they adjust my rate for Obamacare?
So the way it works is there's really three parts to the process of using healthcare.gov and accessing coverage through the marketplace. The first part is setting up an electronic account at healthcare.gov, if that's the way you go. Second is qualifying for financial assistance. And then third is the actual shopping experience. So when you apply for financial assistance, initially they're going to base your eligibility on the income that you reported in your tax return for tax year 2012. If your income that you expect this year is significantly different than that, then you can submit verification or estimate of what you expect your income to be this year, and the tax credit would be based on your estimated income for this year. And then when you go through the year, if you find that there are significant differences between what you estimate and what you actually earn, you can report that back to the health insurance marketplace, and your tax credit will be adjusted.
Okay. And Alan in Clintonville, you're on the air. You are on Medicare now.
Yeah. Okay. My question is, and it sort of made the couple of times ago caller, I'm on Medicare, but I pay $120 a month for a supplement that covers everything. Is there a supplement available through the Affordable Health Care Act that is cheaper than that it will cover everything?
There are no Medicare supplemental or Medigap policies offered through the health insurance marketplace. But one potential option is through the Medicaid program for lower income Medicare beneficiaries. There are several programs designed to pay all of your out-of-pocket Medicare expenses or at least your Medicare Part B premium. So if you're having difficulty paying those expenses, I recommend that you contact the Department of Job and Family Services. You can apply online or through the mail for what are sometimes called Medicare premium savings programs, and those can help to reduce your out-of-pocket expenses as a Medicare beneficiary. But in terms of healthcare.gov and the marketplace, there really aren't any products there for folks who are already on Medicare.
Okay. Another good question. Thanks a lot, Alan from Clintonville. We have an email from Frank. He says, I am a type 1 juvenile onset diabetic, and my insurance dropped me the minute I turned 18. After spending 5 years uninsurable, I was all too happy to help Obama campaign when he first ran, specifically because he was in favor of health care reform. Of course, his initial reforms fell flat, but even with the compromise of ACA, I am very glad that no one else has to go through the same ordeal I had to go through to get medication for a condition I couldn't help getting. One more call. We have just time for a very, very quick call. Doug in Cleveland, you're on the air. Just about 30 seconds.
Ma'am, my name is Doug Bowen. I just retired in June. I'm 62. I don't have any medical coverage at all. I'm trying to get on Medicare in Ohio, but I heard that it was tied up in the courts. And I never go to doctors. I really don't need any medicines. I'm not on any
not yet.
Anything at all.
Mm-hmm.
No, not yet. Not
okay.
On any.
All right. Well, Trey?
If you're a single person with income below $16,000 a year, you would likely qualify for expanded Medicaid through the state of Ohio. You should think about going and applying at benefits.ohio.gov. And it's a really simple application process, and that should get you coverage until your Medicare kicks in at age 65.
All right, Doug, hope that helps. I have one more question, Trey, that I'm going to ask you off the air if you can wait. And
sure.
Thanks to everybody for listening. This is All Sides with Dan Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.